I love a good mystery, and so does everyone else. In fact, everyone loves a good family mystery, especially one with as many twists and turns as June's Journey.
I know that our listeners will absolutely love this game because you are uncovering the mystery of June's sister's murder, and you're becoming a detective. You're looking for clues, and each scene will lead you to a new thrilling storyline.
This is a great way to engage your observation skills to uncover key pieces of information that lead you on to many chapters of mystery, danger, and romance. Right now, I'm in the process of interviewing family members, and this is bringing me back, just so you know, to my days in law enforcement, and I'm having such a blast with it because it is so much more lighthearted, but it also has the mystery of where will this take me?
You can even chat and play with or against other players by joining a detective club. You'll even get the chance to play in a detective league to put your skills to the test. Megan, I think we should join a detective club together. We've got this.
Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover
inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast features criminologists discussing sensitive themes and topics. Listener discretion is advised. A young woman is burned alive, surviving just long enough to identify her attacker. But in the end, would it be enough for her family to find justice? This is the Jessica Chambers story. Hi, Amy, and hello, listeners and viewers. Well, today's episode... Hi, okay. Today's episode is one that has been on my, not just my list, Amy, but on my mind for several years. I followed it so closely when it was originally in the news, and that was almost 10 years ago. Since then, it's been in the news several times for various reasons, major developments, some of them very shocking. It's also been a case that was suggested by several listeners on our Suggest a Case forum and via Instagram. And so thank you to all listeners who've put this out there as a suggestion. Amy, I'm assuming you do know this case.
I listened to the podcast on it. Did you listen to that? I forget what it's called, but it's like a serialized podcast.
No, I didn't. I've seen the documentaries, though, and all the news. No, I'm surprised, actually. I don't think I realized there was a serialized podcast on it.
I think it's called... It might be called Unspeakable or something. I could be saying it wrong, but
that was
it was really good.
The documentary. Unspeakable was the documentary. Oh. So maybe they turned it into...
Okay. Yeah.
That's what it was. It was a several part documentary that I guess they turned into a podcast. So
it was so well done, but hard to listen to.
This is a heartbreaking case. And let me tell you, it's a case that sparks a lot of controversy when it happens. I think that it's a case that left everyone involved, even those of us who are on the outside looking in, with so many questions. And I think, you know, we can probably answer some of those questions today, and we'll give it our best shot. So as always, we welcome and look forward to all of your thoughts. However, I just want to add a trigger warning before this episode, in case you don't know it. This is one of those horrific crimes, and it has a lot of details that will be difficult to hear, particularly when we discuss the crime itself and the immediate aftermath. So for this episode, extra listener discretion is advised. Now let's meet Jessica. Jessica Lane Chambers was born on February 2nd, 1995, to Ben Chambers and Lisa Daughtry. Jessica's mother, Lisa, was a nurse, while her father, Ben, was a mechanic. Now, Amy, Ben had some trouble with drugs early in Jessica's life, and he was arrested and spent time in prison. But when Ben came out, he turned his life around, and the job he obtained as a mechanic, believe it or not, I think this is ironic, was for the sheriff's department. So obviously,
that's great that they hired him. Yeah.
Right? And a nice turnaround there. Though Ben and Lisa separated when Jessica was pretty young, they remained a close family, all living in Cortland, Mississippi. Now, I didn't know about Cortland, but it's a very small town about 60 miles south of Memphis. Pretty equal in racial diversity, I would say. But when I say small, Amy, I mean small town. At the time of the events we're discussing today, there were probably around 500 people residing in the town.
Oh, wow. That's a real small town where everyone knows everyone, right?
Yeah. I mean, my graduating class in high school was over 500, I think. So yes, most people knew each other. Back to Jessica. She was an athlete in high school, and she was loved by almost everyone. And she was known as an outgoing girl who got along with all people. As I said, her parents separated when she was small, but Jessica had brothers and sisters on both sides. In fact, in total, she had 5 siblings. But tragedy struck when Jessica's older brother, one of her 5 siblings, was killed in his late 20s in a car accident.
How old was Jessica?
Jessica was in her teens. So this was very obviously a major blow to the family, but it was particularly devastating to Jessica. I assume she was close or pretty close with him. And after this event, Jessica got involved with some questionable friends and some drugs for a period in high school. But despite this turn, Jessica graduated from high school in 2013 and began working at a clothing store while she decided where she wanted to attend college and what she wanted to do. I read that she was interested in a couple of different areas. One was writing, also possibly teaching or nursing. But unfortunately for Jessica, she would never get the chance to pursue her future dreams. Now, on December 6th, 2014, Jessica was spending the day with her friend Keisha. And they were driving around town, as kids do in a small town, teenagers. And they made a stop to pick up a guy named Quentin Tellis. And this was a new friend of Jessica's. I don't think Keisha knew him very well. According to Keisha, they smoked some marijuana and dropped Quentin off before noon. And then Jessica dropped Keisha off and was home by 2 p.m. And she lived with her mother. According to Jessica's mother, Lisa, she took a nap. Like she fell off, I think her mom said, in the recliner just after 2 o'clock. And then Jessica got a phone call around 4:25 p.m. And so she told her mother that she was running to the M&M convenience store and would be back soon. Now, the M&M was a regular gas station stop for Jessica. She went there often. It was kind of like the gas station, but also the convenience store where everyone got their, you know, snacks and everything else, cigarettes, things of that nature.
It was probably a hangout for the young kids also.
Yeah, I think it was a hangout. Gosh, we hung out at 7-Eleven. Did you have a hangout?
We had Wawa's where I come from.
Oh, that's right. Now, we know based on later surveillance that Jessica was indeed at that M&M convenience store around 5:20 p.m. because the footage shows her gassing up her car, speaking with the clerk, who I'm sure she knew, and making a phone call before driving away.
Sorry, Megan, when you say making a phone call, you mean on a payphone?
No. The surveillance shows her on a cell phone. Okay. Everyone had cell phones. It was 2014, so about 10 years ago.
Okay.
Fair question. About an hour and a half later at 6:48 p.m., Jessica called her mother to say she'd be back in a little bit. But this was the last call Jessica would make. At around 8 p.m., two men driving down a rural road in Cortland, Mississippi, spotted a car on fire off the side of the road. They called 911 immediately, and within 2 minutes, the fire department arrived. I guess that's also a benefit of a small town, quick response. But what they found was far worse than a burning car, Amy. A young woman burnt to a char from head to toe, walked slowly out of the fire. Apparently, she was only clothed in her underwear at the time. And she was saying, help me, help me, even though I don't think it was as audible as that.
She wasn't engulfed in flames at this point.
From what I understand, she wasn't in flames, but she was burned. And it was obvious how, I mean, she was blackened. Her whole body was blackened.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't, unfortunately, she wasn't recognizable. And I think shocked first responders covered this, you know, terribly burned woman with a blanket as she collapsed to the ground. They asked who she was. They were asking, trying to get information for her. Because, again, she wasn't recognizable, even in a small town where people knew each other. She could barely respond, and her name came out muffled. But one man on the scene seemed to understand what she was saying and knew her. Again, this is a small town. I think that when asked her name, I read that she got out, like, instead of Chambers, they heard, like, Thambers. You know, it was very muffled. Her voice box, everything was burned. But in fact, they did recognize, one of the first responders recognized that this was Jessica Chambers. Now, when asked who did this to her, Jessica, again, voice very muffled and damaged, said something that sounded like Eric or Derek. And this would become a center point.
If I recall, Megan, I was going to say this would become a central part of this case.
Absolutely huge. I don't think anyone knew how big.
How many people were around to hear that account? Was it just two first responders?
At first it was two, but then it was several. There were many more first responders that showed up, especially when they realized this was
How many people heard her say that name?
Several, at least seven or eight.
Oh, okay.
Oh yeah, it was many people who heard this. And keep that in mind. We'll revisit this again. At this point though, Jessica was in such bad shape that she had to be airlifted from the scene to a Memphis hospital with a burn unit. Jessica's mother was informed of her daughter's situation, and Lisa immediately drove the 60 miles to Memphis, where the devastating truth of Jessica's case was made clear. I don't think Lisa knew how bad it was until she arrived there. Jessica had burns on over 96% of her body. It was awful, and there was really no hope for survival. The pain was excruciating. Doctors can barely explain it, and there was little that the doctors could do. Lisa spent her final moments with her daughter telling her that if living was just too painful, she should just go ahead and let go. And that's exactly what Jessica did, passing away from her burns early on the morning of December 7th with her mother present.
So tragic.
Oh, this is a tragedy. I mean, this is such an awful crime, but this is a homicide now. And investigators jumped quickly into action to find out who could have burned a 19-year-old teenager alive.
Megan, other than the fact that Jessica was able to inform them that someone did this to her, were there any other reasons for them to believe that this was an intentional fire? Like, why not just think it was a car fire, right? Those could happen.
No, it's possible. I don't think they knew definitively that this was a homicide. I think it was suspected at this point that it was, though, because of what she said. Yes. And there's going to be evidence later on that shows that this fire was set and it wasn't an accidental one. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though, because the first responders must have known something because they asked who did this to you. Mm-hmm. So they must have suspected right away that this was not an accident. The sheriff's department in town called in all resources to help with this crime. They were a small town. They called in the FBI and the Mississippi Bureau of Investigation. And the first place they began was with the crime scene itself. Now, outside the burned up car, detectives discovered Jessica's cell phone. So this would be key, as we know. They also discovered a piece or two of her bra. Remember I said Jessica had emerged from the fire only wearing her underwear and no other clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Jessica's keys were also found by a person walking his child on the side of the road about a quarter of a mile from the scene.
Hmm.
So these items, along with Jessica's car, were sent to the lab for an arson investigation and to see what other evidence they could collect.
Megan, how far away was this from that convenience store?
Very close, within a mile.
Very close.
Yeah, okay. This was close. The team also began to look into this Derek or Eric angle, because as you had asked, many people heard this. So they are looking at the crime scene. They're looking into who Eric or Derek could be, who Jessica knew. And then they have to interview Keisha and Quentin Tellis, because these are the last people Jessica was with that day other than her mother. So Keisha told the police about how she'd been driving around with Jessica and they were smoking marijuana for a bit. And when interviewed, Quentin Tellis also verified these details, saying that, yep, they drove around. Jessica had dropped him off before noon, and that was the last time he had seen Jessica. But Quentin had some other information, Amy, pointing detectives to a man named Derek Holmes. Who was Derek? Well, he was a registered sex offender, a local, who Quentin said knew Jessica and appeared to be interested romantically in Jessica.
So I'm assuming Quentin knows, I'm sorry, Megan, I'm assuming Quentin is told that she said Eric or Derek? He didn't just give this information without knowing that part.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay.
And I guess a helpful Quentin says, well, actually, I know someone. And the police were very interested in this suspect because this is their first lead in terms of a Derek. So they bring him in for questioning. Also, remember, he's the usual suspect in terms of being a registered sex offender. So they're going to be even more interested in speaking with him.
Is Derek and Quentin friends, acquaintances, or how do they know each other, these two?
I think small town, again, that they know each other, but I don't believe they were friends.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but they weren't enemies as far as we know.
No, not that I know of, no.
Okay.
Okay, so Derek is brought in for questioning, and when asked for his alibi, he said that he spent the night inside the house with his mother. Which,
not great.
No, it's not a great alibi. It seems questionable, and I'm sure investigators were suspect at first, but they interviewed other family members of his and neighbors, and enough of them that they were able to confirm that Derek was home all evening. So the police, they didn't let it go immediately, but they were pretty sure that he wasn't the Derek they were looking for. And they followed up with many other Erics and Dereks in the area and surrounding counties, but they couldn't find anyone who necessarily knew Jessica, or even if they did know Jessica, someone who was around the time of her murder. So they really couldn't find an Eric or Derek that was linked to this crime. And they tried.
Are they working any other angles? I'm assuming they can't put all their eggs in one basket here and rely
Absolutely.
On, you know, this woman was in shock and it's possible she wasn't saying Eric or Derek at all.
That's a great point. And yes, they were working other angles. And in fact, they were about to get a pretty big break. Remember, they sent that evidence in to the lab? Well, when Jessica's phone was analyzed, first of all, no Eric or Derek could be located in any of her contacts or any of her discussions over months. I think police were surprised. They couldn't find anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a new number in her phone, a man with whom she was corresponding, whose number she hadn't yet saved. This is a bad habit of mine, just so you know. I always talk about this with James. I don't save people's numbers right away. I wait. I don't know what I'm waiting for, like maybe to see if they're permanent or not. So I have a bunch of numbers as well that just exist there. But it was clear that Jessica had only recently met him, but very quickly, within it seemed like maybe a day or two of meeting, this man was making sexual overtures towards Jessica via text message. But it didn't seem like Jessica was reciprocating. It seemed like she was kind of dismissing these overtures as a joke.
Mm-hmm.
But this recent exchange became even more interesting to law enforcement because, remember I had said that Jessica was caught on footage at M&M making a phone call the evening of her death around 5:20 p.m.? Well, this unidentified man's phone number was the one she was calling in that footage.
Okay, so they need to talk to this guy and I wonder what his name is. Actually, I think I remember, but I'll let you tell us.
Yeah, they have to speak to him. This is someone she's spoken with just, you know, a couple hours within her death and before her car was found in flames. So who did this number belong to? Well, that was none other than Quentin Tellis, her new friend, the one she was driving around with Keisha that day. Armed with this new information, the FBI agents spoke to Quentin for a second time, and Quentin makes a stunning new statement, Amy. This is information that he had not released before, but now Quentin says that he and Jessica, in fact, had a sexual encounter one time before in her car behind his house. The way they did it, I won't, like, not particular, but, you know, they kind of leaned the seat back to do whatever they did in her
and
car.
It's very clear why he's telling this story, because he suspects his DNA will be found in Jessica's car.
This is possible.
Oh, no, he admits he was there, actually, anyway.
He does admit that he was in the car. But this information really piques law enforcement curiosity. First of all, he had not revealed that information before. He said they were just friends. But also, just so you know, I mentioned the car or the seat leaning back, not because I think it's the most interesting point, but to law enforcement it was, because when they found Jessica's car, after when they analyzed it, the seat was leaned all the way back. So
As if someone taller was possibly driving it?
No, as if though, like Quentin had said, they had a sexual encounter and they leaned the seat back while they were doing so. So it seems he's describing a situation that matches the way the seat is leaned back. So police officers are like, wait, did you have a sexual encounter the evening of her death? And that's why you're telling us the seat was leaned back, because it matches what we found. But he said no. In fact, he said it happened the week before.
So she never moved her seat back? Like, it just seems like a very strange thing to say.
It's a very strange thing to say, and it's a very odd coincidence. But Quentin said, nope, it did not happen. It happened the week before. And then he reminded law enforcement that he had not seen Jessica after she dropped him off earlier that day.
Did he say he spoke to her? Did he admit to talking to her around 5 p.m.?
Yeah, but he said that he was in another town that evening. But you know what's also odd, Amy? When detectives went through his phone, he gave his phone over. It was clear that he deleted Jessica's contact information and all of her text messages. Now, why would you do that? When asked why he'd done that, you know what he told the police? He said, well,
she was mad that she wouldn't hook up with him.
Sorry?
Was he upset that that she wouldn't hook up with him again or something like that?
That's probably a good response. But he actually said something you might find a little more colder. He said, well, she was dead, so he didn't need her information anymore.
Were they able to tell when it was deleted? Like, did he delete it before?
No, he deleted it after. But it was pretty quick after the news had surfaced. Now, okay. So he said he was in another town. The police are really interested in Quentin's story. So they verified that Quentin bought a prepaid debit card in the nearby town, Batesville. Batesville is about 10 minutes, maybe 15 to, you know, the end of town from Cortland. He had bought this card at 8:26 p.m. So that was about 20 minutes after the 911 call came in. This doesn't provide him with an alibi, though it maybe does tighten the timeline if he's involved. Mm-hmm. But while Quentin seemed like a good suspect, there wasn't really enough evidence to prove that he had anything to do with assaulting Jessica or setting her on fire at this point.
Were they able to confirm that he was in the town he said he was?
Yes. They were. He did buy. Surveillance showed that he bought that prepaid card. And I think maybe even his record showed at 8:26 p.m. But hold on to that.
Like his cell phone.
Yes. Yes. Okay. It was absolutely confirmed that the 8:26 p.m. Purchase of the debit card was Quentin Tellis.
Okay.
So now the police are looking at other leads. Jessica had a boyfriend. His name was Travis Sanford. He had known gang connections, but at the time of Jessica's death, he was incarcerated on burglary charges. However, they're looking into him because it was known that he was a very jealous type. And detectives wanted to see, even if he's incarcerated, did he possibly have any involvement in this crime through gang members outside of the prison? Mm-hmm. So they looked at this angle pretty hard. And although they pressed pretty hard, they couldn't find any connection to Jessica's murder as gang activity. Plus, they said that, for what it's worth, Travis was seemingly devastated by Jessica's loss, and they believed that he was truly shocked and surprised. So at this point, you know, I think it's like the other suspect. They haven't ruled him out, but they don't think he's the strongest lead.
Do they, meanwhile, I'm not sure if you know, but I guess we could assume that they were having eyes on Quentin during this time.
Quentin was incarcerated in connection with a burglary charge. So remember when I said when they went back? Oh, did I say that? No. Okay. That might have been a little bit after. But
so Travis is incarcerated. So Travis and Quentin are both incarcerated.
Quentin's not yet incarcerated, but he will be at a certain point. So just hold on to that.
Gotcha.
Yes, they're still okay. Looking at Quentin. Yeah. I mean, he's still let's be clear. He is their top suspect, but they're trying, I think, not to have tunnel vision as well and look at other suspects.
Which is good.
Very good. But there were months that went by and they didn't have any direct leads and the case was kind of hitting a wall. So they went back again and re-examined the phone data. They had always had Jessica's, but now they had Quentin's cell phone information as well. And interestingly, law enforcement was able to see that both Quentin and Jessica's phones put them in the same location after 6 p.m. on December 6th.
And what
now? That's when Jessica was the call came in about Jessica and the fire at 8 p.m. And if you recall, Quentin said he did not see Jessica after noon on that day when she dropped him off. And now the cell phone is showing them their cell phones together.
Where are they together? Are they at the convenience store? Are they at someone's house?
Oh, that thought. I promise I'll get there. But good questions. So Quentin was interviewed a third time. Now, this time, he's in jail, as he was incarcerated in connection with a burglary charge. A lot of burglary going on here. Quentin was cooperative and listened to the new information about the cell phone tower. And now he seems to change his story a little bit. Again, remember, this is a second change. Police showed him that they had this data showing Jessica and Quentin's cell phones pinging off the same phone towers that night in that nearby town, Batesville. And that was around 6 p.m. So Quentin thinks about it and says, because he had gone to Batesville, that was the town he went at 8:30 or 8:27 to purchase that phone card. But he said, oh, yeah, you know, I did go to Batesville earlier that evening around 6 p.m. with my friend Big Mike. We drove to Batesville. Apparently Batesville is where some of the food places were. I don't know if Cortland had some. So he said that, yeah, we stopped at Taco Bell. And in fact, we did see Jessica there. We talked to her for a couple minutes, but I was with Mike and she was in her own car. Okay, according to Quentin, he then went back to Cortland with his friend Mike. Mike drops him off and he stays at home for a little while. And then again, right after 8-something, he returns to Batesville to purchase that prepaid debit card for his girlfriend who lived in another town so that she could afford to visit him.
Okay, so this is easy. Let's talk to Big Mike.
Great. So that's what the police say. We got to talk to Big Mike right away. All right. This is a serious change to the story. So they go to Big Mike. He's obviously easy to find. He's Big Mike. And what he says is that, no, I was not with Quentin Tellis that evening. In fact, he was in Nashville watching a Titans game, and he had driven himself there. So his truck was unavailable as well. So Quentin could not have been with him or in his vehicle. So this is big trouble for Quentin. And when the police returned to confront him, I'm sure you can guess, but his story changed again.
Okay. Did he say he was out with, oh, I meant Little Mike?
No.
Because he totally changed who he was with?
That's a fair question. Oh, wrong Mike. Yeah, you would think something like that. But his new story, oh, yeah. You know, in fact, I was with Jessica that evening. We did go to Batesville to eat around 6 p.m. So that Taco Bell, he wasn't with Big Mike. He was with Jessica. And then afterwards, they returned to his house. And behind his property, the two smoked marijuana in Jessica's car until she left right after 7 p.m.
This is a big change in story.
And not a good one.
And I'm assuming police ask him, why did you lie to us? Does he say he forgot?
Like, I don't know what his, I think his reason was that he was afraid to be linked with her. So I think, you know, there was some fear there, although I don't know that to be certain. At first, his changing stories were, I forgot or I should have told you. But this one is a direct confrontation of something, okay. You know, refuting something that is very, very clearly a lie. So the evidence against Quentin is really mounting. And the police, they felt ready to make a move at this point. In February 2016, about 14 months after her murder, Quentin Tellis was indicted for the murder of Jessica Chambers. Now, quick question. What do we know about Quentin, right? Who is he and what's his background? I can tell you that I don't know too much about his past, but I was able to find that Quentin definitely had a criminal history. Burglary seemed to be his crime of choice. But listen to this. He was released after 1 year from a 5-year sentence for a burglary. Okay, so he only served 20% of that sentence. And then he's caught again, Amy, and sentenced to 8 years for another burglary. And he's released after just under 2 years from an 8-year sentence.
Okay. And then this happens. Or yes. Is this after?
No, let me tell you. He was released from that second burglary charge early, 2 years, in 2014. And that's when Jessica was killed. Mm. Right. It seems that burglary, again, his crime of choice. There are also news reports. Those were definitely convictions. But I saw news reports as well that Quentin was charged with a DUI, larceny, and an attempted sexual assault as well. I don't believe those charges resulted in convictions. Mm-hmm. So while there might not have been much physical evidence connecting Quentin to Jessica's murder, there's plenty of circumstantial. And I think given this history, the police are really thinking that he is the most likely suspect here. Mm-hmm. So what would happen with Quentin? Well, he didn't turn around and admit any guilt. He didn't entertain a plea. He went to trial.
I'm assuming she was unfortunately too badly burned that they couldn't perform a rape kit.
That's correct. They weren't able to determine whether or not there was a sexual assault. Yeah.
Okay.
Jessica's family was happy that an arrest had finally been made. But a lot of people in town weren't so sure, Amy. Remember I said that the town was very racially diverse, but equally diverse? I think there was a racial divide with a lot of people in town feeling that it was just easier to pin this awful crime on the obvious black male suspect with a criminal history. And while there wasn't a direct connection to Quentin per se, the case did go to trial. He was indicted. Mm-hmm. So in October 2017, the trial against Quentin Tellis began, and it was a packed courtroom. This was a media sensation, if you recall. Mm-hmm. The prosecution was going for a motion first and foremost. When they called the first EMT, I believe his name was Cole, who saw Jessica first, he described the awful scene and Jessica's cries for help. He described her physical appearance as so charred. Her hair was fried. He was describing how unrecognizable she was. He cried on the stand as he described holding her hand and lying her down on the ground and being with her. It was very clear, just so you know, that this man was emotionally scarred and really destroyed. And at this point, other than Quentin and maybe some of his supporters, there wasn't a dry eye in the courtroom. This was extremely emotional testimony. But he also said on cross-examination from Quentin's lawyer that Jessica's last statement was that Eric or Derek had done this to her. And then the defense put on a parade of first responders who followed, and they echoed the same testimony that it was Eric or Derek. And unfortunately, it wasn't really the defense, I should say, who put on the first responders. It was the prosecution. And I think they were going for a motion, but I think it backfired because so many of them just kept reiterating Eric or Derek, which reinforced the defense in this case, which was that it wasn't Quentin Tellis, it was Eric or Derek.
Mm-hmm. It's a decent point. I mean, if you have that many people, if it was only one or two people who heard it, the fact that you have like half a dozen people and they all are hearing the same thing.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this is.
Let me ask an obvious question. Did Quentin have any nicknames or aliases that sound like Eric or Derek?
No, he did not.
Like no one was able to say there was anything.
No, I do believe the prosecution tried to elicit that from someone who knew him at some point, but it really, there was no Eric or Derek. And also,
now, was there any experts? Were there any experts who, like linguistic experts who can talk about how Quentin could maybe sound like Eric or Derek if your voice is harmed?
That's a really good question.
In some way?
At this trial, there was not a linguistic expert. I'm just going to say that for now. They did have other experts. So the prosecution called a DNA expert. I don't think this was great testimony. Remember the keys? Remember Jessica's keys were found a quarter mile down the road? Well, the DNA expert found that there were four male contributors. Jessica's DNA was on it. Quentin was one of the four. But the defense said that, he was in her car. This wouldn't be that odd. It doesn't indicate murder. Plus, you've got three other male DNA contributors. So I don't think this was a very strong point or the best evidence for the prosecution. And also from this, I want to say that Quentin's attorney, Darla Palmer, a very skilled defense attorney, his family had paid for an outside private defender. She was able to show that Jessica had some questionable associations, had been involved with probably not a great crowd, some drug use. So I think putting some further reasonable doubt and suggesting that there are other possible suspects here that the police haven't looked at. But the prosecution, their main evidence and the strongest evidence they had was the cellular phone records. This was the primary case against Quentin. Also, his lies, frankly. Mm-hmm. So the prosecution's expert testified that the evidence showed that Quentin and Jessica's phones were traveling together at the same times and were at the same location between 6 and 8 p.m.
Sorry, what happens after 8? His phone goes to Batesville and her phone stays?
Correct. Yes. The investigator that led the cell phone investigation portion, and his name was Paul Rowlett, He plotted the data points on a map and showed that between 6:30 and 7:30, in particular, the pings from Jessica and Quentin's phones were identical. And also, something, remember I told you the M&M gas station, they had surveillance camera? Well, they also had, this surveillance was inside, but there was also surveillance camera outside, which was directly pointed at the front of Quentin's house because he lived right near that M&M gas station.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so let me talk a little bit about what the video showed. It showed that at 7:26 p.m., a vehicle was seen leaving Quentin's home, and at the same time, Jessica's phone was moving, both to the spot where Jessica was ultimately found. So her phone is moving, and there's a vehicle moving from his house at 7:26. Surveillance also showed that a vehicle returned to Quentin's house and drove to a shed on the property, which I guess could also be seen from the surveillance, at around 7:50 p.m. Now, in the shed were gasoline containers, just so you know, among other things that one would find in a shed. After this stop, the vehicle headed back towards the direction where Jessica was later found. And only around 10 minutes later, after that vehicle left Quentin's property, Jessica was discovered on fire. So,
I mean, this is pretty strong circumstantial evidence.
Very strong.
I'm assuming in the video they couldn't tell the exact car because it was too grainy.
You're so smart, Amy. That's exactly right. They couldn't tell the car or the driver. But the prosecution implied that Quentin thought he killed Jessica or severely harmed her on his property, that they had some type of altercation, and that he drove her to that site on the side of the road not too far from his home, went back to get gasoline, and then returned to the crime scene and set Jessica on fire to get rid of any evidence. So how does the defense counter this? Because this seems very strong, right? Well, Darla Palmer attacked the data, first of all, saying that it wasn't really as precise as the prosecution alleged. She said, yeah, it looks great. It looks fancy, those data points. But she points out there aren't many, or she elicits testimony that there aren't many cell phone towers in this small town. So the estimates, they're not very strong as other locations where there are several towers because everyone's phones are going to kind of ping off the same towers, perhaps. Okay. So inaccurate science was the focus of the defense, and they were able to show that while Jessica's phone had a lot of data points, so a lot of those pinned maps, Quentin's phone had much fewer in terms of data points. So they said this wasn't that strange given the small town, and they said his home's proximity to the crime scene. He lived right there. So they were able to kind of discredit some of this, you know, seemingly very strong cell phone evidence. The defense also discredited the surveillance, pointing out that it didn't show Quentin or his vehicle on it, nor where those other vehicles went after leaving his residence. Again, a small town, people are in their cars, they drive to a gas station, they drive to a friend, they're back right away. Mm-hmm. At closing, the prosecution alleged that Jessica met with Quentin at his house in her car. But at that time, they said that he likely sexually assaulted her or attempted to, and then he killed her, which it could have been in anger or in an attempt to cover up his crime. They said that after he drove her car to that spot down the road where she was found, returning home to get a can of gasoline, returning to the scene and setting Jessica and her car on fire. And then he leaves very quickly for that Batesville town to establish an alibi.
I mean, Megan, at first, it seemed to me almost like a slam dunk, but I see reasonable doubt, I have to say.
Okay. Well, let me finish. Quentin sent Jessica one text message after 8 p.m. saying he wasn't free that night because he had a friend visiting. And that was the last message he sent to Jessica. It was an hour later that he had deleted her contact and all her messages. And the prosecution said, well, clearly that's because he knows that she's deceased, and he's now covering his tracks. Defense attorney Darla Palmer closed by reminding the jury that Jessica's own words, heard by so many, were that Eric or Derek had done this to her and not Quentin Tellis.
What does the prosecution say about the name? Are they just saying she was confused or
correct,
that they heard her wrong? Okay.
Or that she really couldn't speak clearly at this point. Okay. Or also, they did say that she was in such a state of shock, it's possible that she was confused, which is very possible, actually, given the state of shock that she was in.
Yeah.
So the defense ends with, you know, this idea that it's someone else. There's no physical evidence. And even the circumstantial evidence isn't quite as strong as it looked on the surface. But what would a jury think? Well, I don't know if you know what happened with this jury. And I didn't realize this, but it was very interesting, Amy. One day after the closing, the jury came back with a verdict. But there was a problem. When the judge asked if it was unanimous, one juror shouted no, which is not very standard. The jury apparently did not agree on the verdict, and by law, they were required to do so. It had to be unanimous. Okay, so the judge sends them back, and they come back to the court 30 minutes later. This time, when they return, they said that they found Quentin not guilty. But when the judge polls the jurors, some of them say that they found him guilty.
Oh, no. Okay.
So it's not, the problem is it's not unanimous again.
Yeah.
So the jury doesn't seem to understand the instructions here. And the judge is very clear, explains it. And after deliberating for yet another hour, they come back and they report to the court that they cannot come up with a unanimous vote. I believe there were more. I think it was about 8 in favor of guilt and 4 in favor of innocence. But regardless, this ended in a mistrial.
I'm not surprised.
No, I wasn't surprised about the way it ended. I was surprised about the jurors and the instructions and coming back a couple times. Definitely could make a strong case for clearer jury instructions, right? So, was this over? No. The prosecution was determined, and they tried Quentin for a second time only a year later. This time, the key difference was that the prosecution presented doctors, specialists. One of those was a burn specialist who talked about how Jessica's injuries were so substantial and so severe that it would have made speaking very, very difficult. And it would have made it almost impossible to speak clearly. You know, I think they're trying to discredit the Eric or Derek angle here. And I believe the doctor also talked again about the shock that Jessica would have been in. They had a second doctor who also reported that even though it was hard to determine injuries on Jessica, they were able to find bruising on her chest. And I think the bruising was new at the time, and the prosecution was trying to support the claim that there was, in fact, an assault on Jessica before she was set on fire. It seemed a stronger case this time, Amy. But despite this new evidence, the second jury also could not come to a unanimous decision. And this time, the jury was split down the middle. It was even, 6-6 for innocence and for guilt. So this was a second mistrial. So is this the end for Quentin Tellis? Well,
I mean, the prosecution may not want to spend the time and money to retry this case after two mistrials.
That's absolutely true. But there was another murder, Amy, that was possibly connected to Quentin. You see, not quite a year after Jessica's murder and before his first trial had even begun, 34-year-old Ming Chen Xiao, known to her friends as Mandy, was an exchange student living in Louisiana, and she was found brutally stabbed in the apartment where she lived. Now, the police searched Mandy's apartment and found a receipt from a local Walmart timestamped the day before her murder, so they got the surveillance. What did this surveillance reveal? Well, it showed that Mandy had gone into Walmart by herself, and when she came out, she got into a black Chevy Impala with a young black male driving. She had purchased painkillers, just so you know, in Walmart, and it seemed that when she came out, she was possibly giving some to her friend or whoever was with her. So when the police went and tracked that vehicle, guess who it was registered to?
Quentin.
That's correct. They found the registration was that of Quentin Tellis. So police checked Mandy's banking records and found that someone had used her debit card after she was murdered. And guess what? That person was Quentin Tellis. But like Jessica's case, Amy, there was no physical evidence to tie Quentin to Mandy's actual murder. They do have him clearly on using her bank card, which is...
Was she sexually assaulted?
She was not sexually assaulted, no. However, someone came forward as well. This was an anonymous tipster and told the police that a friend or someone he knew had kind of been bragging about torturing Mandy to get her PIN number to her ATM to essentially steal from her. The person said once she gave up the PIN number, he murdered her, stabbing her over 20 times. And guess who this friend was? Well, it was Quentin Tellis. So not only was Quentin charged with Jessica Chambers' murder, but he was also charged with Mandy Shaw's murder. And after his second mistrial for Jessica's case, Quentin was extradited to Louisiana, where he pled not guilty to Mandy's murder. Though law enforcement may not have had at this point an airtight case for her stabbing, they did have plenty of evidence to show that Quentin burglarized Mandy's bank card. And if you recall, Quentin has amassed quite a few convictions on his record. So what happens here is that the prosecution attempts to get a plea in this case. They want Quentin to go to prison. They're very concerned about him being on the streets.
Yeah.
So they offer him a plea deal and he takes it. He pleads guilty in 2016 to the illegal use of Mandy Shaw's debit card. And there were drug charges also connected. I believe he was caught with a certain amount of marijuana. For these crimes, though, which may seem lower level to some, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison because he was sentenced as a habitual offender. He already had at least two previous convictions, kind of like three strikes and you're out, similar.
I'm assuming they're okay with this 10 years because that gives them enough time, keep the community safe, and that gives them enough time to gather enough evidence to either retry Jessica's case or to get evidence in Mandy's case.
I'd say that's exactly correct, Amy. The indictment for murder against Mandy Shaw was dismissed, but can be refiled again. I'm assuming, again, they didn't have everything they would have liked. And given what happened in Jessica's case, they wanted to make a very strong case for murder. The district attorney in Mississippi has not indicated whether Quentin will be tried for a third time in Jessica Chambers' murder. So this brings us up to date. Jessica's family was devastated by the second mistrial. I mean, obviously. They had to sit through all of this. Awful, awful case. And Jessica's mother, Lisa, died not long after in 2021, never having seen justice for her daughter. Many of the original investigators involved in Jessica's case have either retired or now work for other agencies. Some say, Amy, that now, bringing new eyes to the case is exactly what's needed to possibly bring Jessica Chambers justice. All I can say at this point is that I think we both hope that both Jessica's murderer and Mandy's are punished. Many people now believe these two are one and the same.
So Jessica Chambers' case, the court of public opinion is that this guy is guilty.
Yes.
Or is there a camp of people that are vocal and believe that he, I know you mentioned like the racial divide at some point. Are you still hearing that?
Yes.
When you research the case?
There is still some echo or sentiment of that. But I think the feeling after the discovery of Mandy Shaw, I think there was more of a feeling that Quentin was guilty and this might have been, misjustice. So, yes, Quentin still has some strong supporters, family members who said absolutely not, he could not have done this. But I don't know that his support is as strong as it once was. Okay, so this is a little bit complicated when we talk about why this happened, the criminal justice system, but it's an interesting part to discuss here. First of all, I believe Quentin Tellis is the correct perpetrator. And unfortunately for Jessica, I think she crossed paths with a violent, antisocial career criminal who I think lacks remorse for what he's done. Quentin is a seasoned and repetitive liar who tried to manipulate law enforcement on several occasions with his changing stories, changing alibis. And I think he believed that, they would believe him, that he was convincing enough. He was well established as a repeat burglary offender. Now think about it. This is something I want to point out. Quentin keeps getting released early from his sentences, right? He's committed serious crimes, yet he's getting out. So the message to Quentin is when he is caught, his punishment isn't that serious.
Are you hinting at differential reinforcement, Megan?
One
of our favorite theories.
I am hinting that what Quentin is learning, the reinforcement that he's getting is commit a crime. And yes, you'll pay a price, but it's not that much of a price. I'm also hinting at the fact that he's not being deterred. There's no deterrence at work here. So without any deterrence for his crimes and, you know, with being released early from two serious crimes, I think the message to him is pretty clear. And unfortunately, he's released from that second burglary right before Jessica was murdered. Such a shame.
Yep.
Do you think that Quentin is the correct perpetrator here?
I lean towards that way, but I also have to say I understand the jury. Sure. I do see reasonable doubt.
Sure.
I'm glad that decision was not in my hands, put it that way.
Yeah. When we address whether or not the criminal justice system got it right, this is very complicated because I think in terms of apprehending the right offender, I think he's the right offender and I think he hasn't been punished for the crime. However, I think the defense presented reasonable doubt and I can see why the jury did not agree. So I agree with you, Amy. I'm glad the decision was not left in my hands.
I think it's important to point out that we've said this before, but innocence and justice are totally different, right? There's like a legal standard and we have rights in the courtroom and people who are guilty go free all the time because of some sort of procedural error, right?
Yeah.
So it's possible, you know, it's also possible that he is guilty, but it's also possible the evidence simply is not there to meet the burden of proof.
Right. And there is a burden of proof. And
unfortunately,
he had a very skilled attorney who I think presented reasonable doubt. I will say for now, I'm glad that he's incarcerated. I think a very dangerous perpetrator is in prison. And I do believe that the only way to deter Quentin from committing crimes is for him to be incapacitated. I don't think Quentin on the streets in his 30s is going to work out well for society. And I do hope that the prosecution will at least be able to go forward with the Mandy Hsiao case at some point. I think there's a pretty good case there. For now, though, I think, I think we'll just be grateful that Quentin is still incarcerated and will be for several more years to come.
I agree.
Okay. Well, that
was
a heavy
one.
And that's everything we have for today's episode. Yes. But before we go, I know that we do have a question, I believe, from one of our patrons. Is that correct?
Yes. So the question is, what are some of your thoughts and opinions on the treatment of pregnant women in the prison system? Well, that's
a really
good question, but, you know, we have the federal prison system and then we have state prison system. So I don't think it's fair to make a blanket statement because I do think there are some facilities, some federal facilities and some state level facilities that actually are doing a decent job. But I would say across the board, no, the treatment of pregnant women, especially in jails as compared to prisons. Jails are short term. People usually are in jails awaiting trial, awaiting transfer, or a sentence that is under a year. So the treatment of women in jails has been pretty horrendous. Pregnant women specifically. And we've heard horror stories in one of our past episodes.
Yes.
We talked about it. In the state system, in the prison system, I think things are a little better. But there's also a lot of issues with, you know, some states make women still be shackled when they're giving birth. Others take the baby away right away, but some states let the mother have the baby for a day or two. So it really depends. What do you think, Megan?
I think this is so interesting. Literally yesterday, I got an email from a listener. Her name is Mallory, and she wanted to point our attention to the unconstitutional conditions in prisons in Alabama and how many times the prisons have been ruled unconstitutional by the courts, the ongoing violence that has happened. And then she pointed specifically to some female issues. And one of the issues was that a woman just gave birth in a jail in Alabama in her shower stall because for hours upon hours of crying that she was in labor, the staff ignored her. They threw her a Tylenol, as I understand it. And because of her ignored medical needs, she again was forced to give birth in a very, very dangerous situation. That did result in some complications, as I understand it. I know that she's okay, but I think this is probably indicative of a bigger problem of ignoring the needs of pregnant women in prisons. And by the way, about 50,000 women a year mm-hmm. are going to be pregnant in prisons and jails. And I think we need to do a hell of a better job, a hell of a lot of a better job to support these women. Mm-hmm. It's a great question. Yep. And I'm actually going to consider an episode as well on this topic. So thank you for that question. Thank you, Amy. And thank you, everyone, for listening and for watching this episode of Women in Crime. We'll see you next time. Women in Crime is written and hosted by Megan Sachs and Amy Schlossberg. Our producer is James Varga. Script editing is by Abigail Bel Castro. Audio editing is by Siler Burr and Jose Alfonso, and music is by Dessert Media. If you enjoy the show, please remember to follow and leave a review. You can also support the show through Patreon, where you can get access to additional ad-free content such as exclusive full-length episodes, lectures, a book club, and virtual happy hours with Megan and Amy. For more information, visit patreon.com/womenandcrime. Sources for today's episode include the documentary Jessica Chambers, An ID Mystery, The Clarion Ledger, People.com, Oxygen.com, Star News, and Dark Horse Press.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.